Welcome to the show. On today's episode, I'm joined by the evil ball genius himself, Mr. John McCullough. John is a marketing expert and sales and business development aficionado, having written books and trained successful business owners worldwide on this stuff. With decades of experience, he's a practicing stoic who was diagnosed with autism in adulthood. He's best known for his no-nonsense approach, which cuts out the noise and nonsense in today's digital marketing age, allowing serious business owners to turn to John to get the answers nobody else is prepared to give them. But today's podcast goes far wider than this, as we delve deep into parenting and a whole load of other stuff. So enjoy. Expect to hear the circumstances in which John had to make a decision between keeping his job and his kids when his marriage broke down, the importance of focusing on the good and learning from it, why people are frequently confusing vulnerability and strength as a virtue, and how hard times create strong men. Strong men create good times. Good times create weak men, and weak men create hard times. Why people are getting boundaries and consequences with kids so badly wrong. John's autism diagnosis, and our duty as parents to prepare our kids effectively for adulthood. The blame equation and how applying it can change your life's trajectory. There are a few ways you can get involved with the show. Firstly, you can follow me on X, formerly Twitter. Secondly, you can hit subscribe and share on your favourite podcast player. Or if you like to watch stuff, check out the show on YouTube. And thirdly, subscribe to my free newsletter called The Journey. You can find the link to this in the episode show notes. I'm pretty excited by the journey, as I'll share with you regularly what I've learned and continue to learn on my own journey. And now, to my conversation with John. I'm tentatively taking my steps on this because I know how your podcast begins, which is often quite amusing in terms of swearing and other stuff, depending on what's been said off air by you and Connor before you hit the record button. So, yeah.
That's quite deliberate. We start when we get on the call by talking about something inappropriate, and then Connor just randomly hits the start button. So people are coming in to an already ongoing conversation. We also do it with our call control calls on a Wednesday lunchtime. It works really, really well because people are looking forward to what the fuck are these two going to be talking about today? And it's almost always inappropriate. I mean, it wouldn't be the same if it wasn't.
Oh, that is amusing. That is amusing. Now, I've brought you on here today, and it's an interesting way that I've kind of found out about you, because I've been doing more on LinkedIn than other platforms in the last little while. I know of you from LinkedIn. You've been referred to me by Toby Swallow, who's also on LinkedIn, the mobility guy. And I primarily know of you regarding your prowess, shall we say, in marketing. But as I've found out more about you, and I've listened to your podcast, and I've listened to some of your, I hate the word content, but some of your information, shall we say.
Ramblings.
Ramblings and whatnot. It becomes clear to me that there's more to you than meets the eye, and not least raising your kids by yourself while starting a business at the same time. And I think that kind of segues kind of quite nicely into what we'll probably talk about in other parts of this podcast conversation, John. How did that sort of all come about? Because I know that you kind of, it was a very much a sort of sink or swim part of your life, but which was going to kind of make or break you from what you've divulged on your own podcast in the past, sort of thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's going back a few years now. I was married. Miserable as sin, you know. And my ex, we had a particularly rough period of time, and I said to her, you need to go and get counselling, anger management, because, you know, you're not acting normally. Normal human beings don't act this way. So she went to counselling and she didn't like it because the counsellor was basically telling her stuff I'd already told her, stuff about her own behaviour and things. Anyway, I gave her mentally 3 months to start making improvements, or I was going to start the proceedings of leaving, because I told myself I'll stick this out until my son's 16, but he was at the time 20 months old or so. And I thought, I cannot deal with this for another 14 plus years, you know. You know, I'll end up killing someone if, and it might just be her, because it won't be myself. So I gave her 3 months, but within 6 weeks, she'd left. She'd just fucked off with someone else. Well, then our life just diverged, and she's now being married. She divorced him, got married again. He divorced her. Now she's with some other bloke, and her life has just spiraled downhill. I'd like to say I don't gloat, but I do. Of course I do. I mean, I'm a human being. And I think gloating is actually a vastly underrated pastime. We all do it, so let's just revel in it and enjoy it when we can. I mean, you can still gloat and feel sympathy, you know. That's really bad, but I'm glad it happened, you know.
Yeah.
So I was left in a situation where I was working down in Porton Down, the MOD, doing software. And I was driving from Stone Market every Monday and coming back on the Friday. And it was just one of the things where I either kept the job and let her waltz off with the kids. And she was, I think she's an unfit mother. And if we get to that point, we can talk about why I think that. It's not just being a bitter ex-husband now. I've got no feelings at all for her. I'm indifferent to her. Or I keep the kids and give up the job. So that lasted about a nanosecond to decide that. So I gave up the job and I was sitting at home thinking, what the fuck do I do now? Got a big mortgage, 3 kids, and I got no income coming in. So I just started writing documentation for some local software firms, and I also copywriting with the local BNI, the BNI chapter. And I was lucky enough to get a contract with a software firm up in Cambridge Science Park, and it was really quite lucrative. And luckily enough, my sales letter landed on the project manager's desk just after he'd come off the phone to someone else on the project saying their incumbent documentation people are crap. And then my thing appeared. And it was just, look, I mean, the lesson there is if you don't put stuff out there, it ain't going to land on that desk, you know?
Yeah. And I like the way you mentioned that. And it will become evident further on in our conversation because, like, I remember my first job from school, I literally bashed out 30 CVs. I got a handful of responses back. And then I got one interview and I got a job. And it just, that's the difference between, how things are done in 1997 versus how things are done now. And
they still work now.
But they still work. This is the thing.
Yeah, I mean, Earl Nightingale, and it might not be his quote, but he used to say, he might have passed it on, he used to say, luck is where preparedness meets opportunity. And it's true, there's opportunity out there. But if you, and getting these things is sometimes lucky. You're in the right place at the right time, saying the right thing to the right person. But if you're not actually getting off your ass and saying these things, then, of course, this person won't hear it. So there is a measure of luck. I mean, luck is functionally anything you can't control, like the random factor. The random factor is functionally the same as luck. And there are no such thing as lucky people or unlucky people. There are observant people and unprepared people and unobservant and unprepared people, really. We all have bad shit happen to us. It's just that, you know, what do you focus on? I always focus on the good. Because there's no point in, anything you focus on historically is a waste of time, really, in the sense that you can't change it. But what you can do is learn from it.
Yeah, and I like that expression. I used to have a similar expression in, because I used to work in a state agency years ago, and I was having a particularly good year, and one of my buddies in sales said to me, oh, you're just lucky. And I was like, there's nothing lucky about it. It's just where careful planning meets opportunity. I'm just putting in all of the reps, doing the things that I know I should be doing in order to hit the figures that I know I can. And it's like a numbers game, isn't it? You do X amount of activities in one end and then out pops something in the other end, provided you don't do something really stupid.
It's the same in business. I get people tell me I'm lucky because I'm not overweight and I've got a six pack and I'm muscular. Yeah, I'm lucky to get up at 6 a.m. and do an hour in the gym every day. That's really lucky, that is. Or maybe it's actually connected, the two things, you know. Yeah. There's a simple exercise people can do so they don't get fat or they can lose weight if they are fat. It's this one. No, thank you. I've eaten quite enough. Dead easy. Anyone can do it.
It's my metabolism. I've got big bones and, you know.
Big ass bone. Very fat belly bone.
No, you just eat too much and you don't exercise enough. That is the two things you cannot argue with, you know.
Not really. I mean, I know there are nuances here and there are metabolic diseases and all kinds of confounding variables, but ultimately it's thermodynamics, isn't it? You know, you eat too much, you're going to get fat. Yeah. Eat less, you might lose weight.
Yeah, I know when a belt notch has gone out on my belt and when I should but be backing off a little bit. I think everyone does. So you're in this position whereby you've landed this job, which is kind of quite lucrative, and you're trying to you're juggling this whilst trying to bring up three kids. That can't have been an easy stage and an easy kind of, must have been a bastion of fire, I would thought.
Yeah, it was. I mean, add to that, my son is disabled. He's got cerebral palsy. And my oldest daughter is autistic, the same as me. I suspect my middle daughter, my middle child, is also autistic, but she denies it and won't get tested. And she's a grown-up, so it's entirely up to her. But it wouldn't surprise me. It is genetic to a large extent. But then again, it could also be learned behavior.
Mm.
But so, yeah, well, it was challenging. And on top of that, I had an ex-wife whose behavior is still to this day somewhat erratic, shall we say. to put it, you know, but I'm being as kind as I possibly can. I don't want to disrespect my ex-wife and the kids' mother publicly. I mean, I'm happy to do it privately, but publicly I won't, because they see it and I want to set an example for them.
I think it's important. I'm glad that you mentioned setting an example. How important is that to you, setting an example as a dad?
Oh, 100%. I mean, you can lecture to your kids all you like, but you know, for instance, if I'm swearing and telling lies and being deceptive in my life, and I'm telling my kids, you've got to tell the truth. Well, they learn from what I do, not what I say. So really it's up to me to, you know, not punish the kids for swearing, but teach them, for instance, to manage their swearing. Like if you swear at grandma and granddad, you're going to get in trouble. If you swear at me, you'll get in trouble. But if you swear in my presence, you not necessarily will. You've got to learn how to manage it. In the same way as, you know, if you tell me a lie, that's much worse than anything you could possibly have done to bring the lie out. You know, if you've done something wrong and you tell me, I'll back you up all the way. But if you don't, and I'll show real loyalty, but if you breach that trust by lying to me, I can't say anything. So I try to lead by example, you know. I think that's really important. And it's the same in business too. I say a lot of business owners and business coaches and mentors, especially the coaches and things, telling business owners, do these things to make your business a success. When you look at their businesses, they're not doing them. And classic example is the ads. I can't get my head around this. Ads on Instagram, paid ads on Instagram, selling products, teaching people how to grow their Instagram following without paid ads. How does that work? I mean, if it's that fucking good, you wouldn't need to be paying for ads to sell this shit, would you?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Do as I say, not what I do. And I don't see it so much on LinkedIn, but I did see it on Twitter. And guys got really kind of upset when I called them out on it. And one thing I see on Twitter quite a lot is content where people are kind of dictating how other guys should live, but these guys have an anonymous account, so their name isn't present. There's no picture of them, and there's no evidence that they are practicing the life that they espouse others should lead. And people get really upset about this on Twitter because they're like, yeah, well, there's a good reason that I've got an anonymous account because I'm in a custody battle with my wife's mother and whatever and stuff. Yeah, okay, I get that. And there's a couple of other very, you know, if you're working, I don't know, for MI5 or something, or you're working in a role where your identity has to be anonymous, or you're on witness protection, there's some very small examples of where you should be anonymous. But for the majority of people on there, there's no reason for them to be anonymous. And
they're just cowards.
Yeah. Well, they are cowards. And I think that And what's worse about that is that a lot of the accounts that you see are father accounts and men accounts. So you're like, hang on a minute, you're being complete and utter hypocrites because you're saying to people you should live your life in a certain way, or putting out tweets, you know, 7 steps to leader to set an example to your kids and whatever. Well, surely the first example you want to set to your kids is not being anonymous on the internet.
I don't get it. It's all this. It's the, I think the catchword these days, the buzzword, is authenticity, isn't it?
Yeah.
I fucking hate that word. I mean, it's a perfectly good word. It's used, got its uses, but people use it completely wrongly.
Yeah.
And let's face it, some people are just authentically fucking awful people. They just are. You know, there's no two ways about it. So I don't say that. I mean, authenticity is a good thing, I suppose. So you know what you're dealing with, but being authentic doesn't necessarily mean that you're a nice or decent person.
You're right.
An authentic arsehole. And Adolf Hitler was fairly authentic. You can't deny that.
But it's
one thing going for him.
There's a faux authenticity. I know what you mean, because there's this kind of like where people are basically trying to, how should I say, put this? I see a lot of where people are trying to garner honor for reveling in victimhood, if that makes any sense.
Oh.
There is this kind of weird authenticity where it's like, woe is me, my life's really shit. And everyone kind of jumps on the comments and go, yeah, so is mine. Da, 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 da. And don't get me wrong, I'm an empathetic, compassionate person, but there is a line between empathy and compassion and, you know, just getting in this pity party. I've been asked to pen an article on this by John Barry, who runs the Center for Male Psychology, and it's what I call kind of helpless, hapless man syndrome, or as Martin Seligman calls it, learned helplessness. You know, where there's these echo chambers of learned helplessness, where it's, oh, my life's so shit. Yeah, so is mine. Let's all just whine about it and do nothing about it to change it, you know?
The problem is, if you bring this up and you point this out to people, you're then victim blaming, aren't you?
Yeah.
That's what they will say. I just can't get my head around that.
Yeah.
I mean, I see it all the time. I'm not on LinkedIn anymore. My daughter manages my account for me, because it's so trivial that the discussions on LinkedIn, they are so trivial. And I found this constant stream of virtue signaling, the helplessness, as you say, the learned helplessness. And this attitude that, and I've even seen it written explicitly, vulnerability is strength. No, it isn't. Look in any dictionary you like and you will see vulnerability is weakness. Now, showing vulnerability takes a certain strength, that I will admit. And sometimes showing vulnerability is necessary. You're certainly desirable. And sometimes it's just not a bad idea. But to say vulnerability is strength is straight out of 1984. War is peace. Love is hate. Vulnerability is strength. No, it isn't. Mm. You know, so let's stop celebrating weakness. Because celebrating weakness gets us right into that quote about weak men creating bad times, which is where we are right now. And it also applies to women. I mean, it was a direct quote, so please, feminists, don't jump on me. Yeah. Weak men and weak women create bad times, and that's where we are now. And it's accelerated and exacerbated by us celebrating weakness. Now, I'm with Jordan Peterson when he says you need to be dangerous. Because if you're dangerous, then meekness and mildness and kindness, they're a choice. If you're weak, you don't have a choice about any of that. You're just fucking harmless, you know? I don't want to be harmless. I want my daughter's boyfriends, I don't threaten them or tell them to behave themselves, but I want them to know just from my demeanor, if they cross a certain line, they will pay in blood, basically. I want them to know this. And they do know it. They pick it up. And I mean, I'm talking because my daughter's got this thing, Holly, the tall guy. So you got these guys of literally 6'2", 6'4", 6'7", and they're terrified of me. I'm 5'5". And they've been afraid of me.
You're like the pit bull amongst Great Danes.
Yeah. But they know that if they cross a certain line, they won't be dealing with an angry father. They'll be dealing with an angry animal, a caveman who's going to stamp on their heads. And it's fine. And it works out very well. And I don't tell them any of this. My daughter tells them for me. I'm okay with that.
Oh, that is amusing. But I think the thing is the coming back to this kind of leading by example and being a kind of role model and being, you know, we've spoken about in the past, you know, where do you see some of the problems that are arising at the moment? Because I know we've spoken in the past about this notion of parents being their kids' best friends and stuff and that. Oh. And you just like, I come across it a lot because I've got two daughters and I see it most, funnily enough, not so much in the dads, but more so in the mums where they're kind of vicariously live their lives through their daughters and they want to be kind of, there's no boundaries, there's no consequences. So you're kind of creating these kind of little princesses that are going into sort of the latter stages of primary school and then into secondary school. My eldest daughter keeps telling me about the fights that are going on at school at the minute. And they're not fights between boys. They're girls scrapping in the playground, you know? So what's going on here? I don't know.
Well, we have to blame successive generations of parents because kids grow up and they become adults and then they're responsible for their own actions. And maybe, you know, it's not a delineated line of say you get to 18, all of a sudden you're responsible. Some people get to 50 and they're not responsible. And some people are very mature at 14. But, you know, between probably the years of, say, I don't know, 12 and 20, you should be growing into adulthood. And then you start to develop your own philosophy of life and your own behaviors. But a lot of that is down to your programming. Well, if you've got shitty parents, it's a much bigger effort of will not to be a shitty child and then a shitty adult afterwards. You know, we know this from the cycle of abuse. Abusers are often, more often than not, have been abused themselves. I don't see that as an excuse, because if you felt like shit when it was happening to you, then surely you must know that it's going to make people that you abuse feel like shit too. But it still happens. We know this statistically. Right? It's a reason, not an excuse. Well, if you've grown up as a child and your parents have not established boundaries, and this quite possibly started in the 1960s and the 1970s, you know, fortunately, I was set boundaries by my parents. My parents, I mean, when I was born, 1965, it was only 20 years after the end of the Second World War. Hmm. And well, that was still in the national psyche. So my parents, my generation is generally a lot more stoic than successive generations. But if, you know, you imagine parents maybe even only 5 or 10 years after mine, they turn out generations of kids who are brought up where you're free to express yourself in any way you like without consequence, without responsibility. Well, what are your fucking kids going to be like? And then what are their fucking kids going to be like? Hmm. Well, we're seeing it now.
Yeah.
We're seeing it now. We see now a situation where kids will misbehave at school and the parents are called in. And whereas any rational parent would be supportive of the teachers because the children's behavior is unacceptable, what do the parents do? They threaten the teachers. My kids wouldn't do that. Leave them alone. Mm-hmm. Well, great. So I can behave like a little shit and maybe violate other children's rights and physical autonomy. And there's no consequence. And my parents will come to the school and stick up for me. Mm. Great. That's a really good recipe for a great society, isn't it? And these people these kids then go on to be soldiers, policemen, politicians, traffic fucking wardens. You know, is it any surprise, for instance, that the Met has just said, oh, we're going to weed out all these awful policemen? Why the fuck are we having this conversation? Why were they not weeded out when they joined the police or before? Mm. Mm. It's endemic in society. There is no consequence for shitty behavior, and it's a big mess. It's a big swamp, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And I think the thing is, as well, is I think what I've witnessed as well is not just, you know, parents going into schools and saying, "Oh well, it's the school's fault," trying to deflect blame away from themselves, but actually just wholesale denial, like their child's denying any knowledge of it. You know, even when there's like a handful of other kids saying, yeah, that kid did it, the kid's denying it, the parents are denying it, and you've kind of got this like, hang on a minute.
It's surreal, isn't it?
Come again? So how does that work then? So what are you going to do when they, you know, when the kid does something more serious as an adult? Is the recipe just to deny that it happened sort of thing? And just like, yeah, you can't just deny CCTV coverage of your son or daughter stabbing someone in the chest. Just wholesale denial is not going to work in that situation. So you've got to somehow, you know, and it's, and what's kind of quite interesting to what you said about shitty upbringings is people assume that shitty upbringings mean, oh, you've been abused or you suffered trauma or you come from a counselor state or whatever. I'm seeing this quite a lot in what you would term well-to-do families who are actually quite affluent, quite wealthy in some respects, but they just, there's this generation whereby, you know, the kids are growing up with smartphones. They're given everything. They're given smartphones at the age of 6 or 7. They're on bloody TikTok, you know, as children, when, you know, you could do a whole podcast episode on TikTok, but when I heard someone say recently, TikTok is like heroin. That's a good enough reason for me not to allow my child access to TikTok. You know what I mean? So, but a lot of parents don't. They just think, all right, well, all of the other parents are letting their kids have unfettered access to the internet, so I better too, because they don't want to be left out. Yeah. Hang on a minute. That is best friend territory. That is not acting in your child's best interest territory. You know?
Absolutely. My eldest said to me, going back a few years now, I said, I used to think you were a very strict parent, but then I realized you weren't at all. You just had boundaries. And within those boundaries, I could do anything. But if I stepped outside them, I was in trouble. And we have this conversation, and even now, and recently she talked about it, because she worked in our business. So we at masterminds, and she would talk about my parenting style quite freely in front of me. So she feels confident and comfortable talking about me and all these things, you know, so that's a good sign. I had a 50th birthday party 8 years ago, and they both came to it. This was the Cork International. We had a business thing. And they were openly challenging me in some of the things I was saying. And again, they felt comfortable doing that, challenging their father, who's presenting, asking questions in front of everybody else. That's how self-assured and confident my children are. And they were respectful, but they had an opinion, they had a thought, and they were asking them. That shows that I've done my job pretty well, I think. Most parents, or it seems like most parents, don't have boundaries, and they are afraid of upsetting their kids. And I don't know, is it they think other parents might think badly? I don't know. I don't get it. My middle daughter, for reasons that I won't go into, I gave her a warning. She was just about to graduate from school. This is over in Ireland. And you've got the prom coming, and you've got all these things happening. And I said to her, if this behavior continues, you know, if you break these rules one more time, you will not be going to these things. She broke the rules, so she didn't go. Oh, man, the language I got from her, she hated it. But she said to me more recently, I'm so glad you did that, because if you had, I wouldn't have graduated. I wouldn't have gone to university. I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now. What is she doing now? She's training to become a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's thanked me for being, at that point, very strict. But it wasn't just random. She had plenty of warning. I once, right, I told her to clean all the rubbish out of her room. And if she didn't do it, she wouldn't be going out that weekend. And she went to go out. And you took her to the pub just over the way here. It's about, I don't know, 10-minute drive away. It was someone's 18th birthday party. All her friends from school were there. And I said, have you cleaned your room? You got rid of all the rubbish? Yes. Okay, so I took her. And I went back home and I thought, I'm just going to check. I went into her room and it was just there. It was just a mess. So I went to this party, and I didn't physically, but I dragged her out of the party in front of all her friends and made her come home and clean her room, and she didn't go back. She said, I was so embarrassed. I was so mortified. Weren't you embarrassed, Dad? And I said, no, you broke the rules, and I warned you what would happen. Now, next time, maybe you'll listen to me. Can you imagine how social fucking disaster, how much of a social disaster that was for her? You're dragged out of this 18th birthday party by your father to go and clean your room because you haven't done it when you were supposed to. That's how seriously I take my parenting. And other parents listening to this might think, Christ, that was a bit rough, or that's bad parenting. I disagree. And so does she.
Mm-hmm.
You know, rules and boundaries. And if you think about it, if you have rules and boundaries, you don't enforce. They're not rules and boundaries at all. What they are is suggestions.
Yeah, and I think the thing is our job as parents is to guide, mentor, and help our kids navigate that part of going from kind of childhood up into adulthood, particularly I think in those years between sort of 10 and 20. And funny enough, when I've spoken to evolutionary psychologists about this. They say that the father's role really comes to the fore in those years, because you're imparting kind of wisdom, judgment, and a number of different other skills into their kind of toolkit that they can begin to use. But one of the aspects of that is kind of in that helping them to emotional regulation and impulse control and that kind of stuff, which doesn't really get talked about a lot, but kind of gets kicked into the long grass. But I think that when you just pose the question, why do people want to be their kids' best friends? I think that it's because you have adults who that they want validation from their children. They want to, if I give my child what they want, then they will like me. But it's not your job as a parent to be liked by your child. It's your job to be their parent. And the problem is, I think when it comes to mums and daughters, often it's the mums kind of to pick up where they left off. So there'll be this kind of psychological warfare that used to go on at school, and then it kind of carries on when mums have their own daughters, and it's a really peculiar thing. Not all mums, because for sure there are mums that rise above it and like, shit, I went down that road when I was a kid, I'm not going to carry on with that, and I won't tolerate it with my own daughter, sort of thing. But it's just a very it's a very interesting, and what I think, you've mentioned that you were diagnosed with autism in your 50s, I think, and you mentioned your kids. As you know, my eldest daughter is autistic. I'm 99.9% sure I'm probably, if I went for a diagnosis, I would be ADHD, but it's kind of one of those ones. I could, but it's going to confirm what I already know. Do I really want to take medication? Probably not. Can I sort of learn about it and find my way through it? Yes, I can. So, but one of the things that often comes up with ASD kids in particular, which is a particular bugbear of mine, is that all behavior is autistic. And what a lot of experts are often saying to parents is, they're not advocating a permissive parenting style, but they are saying, look, that's because of the autism. That's because of autism. We've learned that there is a point at which the autistic behavior kind of stops, and then normal 10, 11, 12 year old behavior starts. And what I've noticed amongst the kind of autistic community, and I don't form any judgment on this because parents are doing what they think is best, but where I've seen kids who are on the autistic spectrum be subjected to permissive parenting, i.e. they can get away with whatever they want with no boundaries or consequences. And they're turning into, and I hate to say it, but they're turning into little monsters.
In the autistic community, there's this idea people like to put out that not only are we special, tongue in cheek, but we are special, as in we should be treated differently. Well, we should have accommodations. Absolutely, especially in public places where we are taxpayers. So, it's not unreasonable for me to say, well, I think airports should be differently designed because, hey, I help pay for these fucking things. Mm. That's reasonable. But what's not reasonable, as you say, is for autistic people to be permitted to violate others' rights. Let's put it that way. So you got an autistic child who say doesn't understand physical boundaries and goes around hugging people. It is not acceptable to say, well, that's okay because he or she is autistic. Because the children that this child is hugging, well, they have a right to bodily autonomy, not to be hugged and kissed and licked. They just do. So it's up to the autistic child and the parents of the autistic child to teach these boundaries. Even if they don't understand them, they must learn them. Now, for me, for example, this is a classic example or an example of how this translates to my life. For me, I can't tell if a woman is into me unless she actually says so. So unless she's actually sitting on my face, it's very difficult for me to tell if she's into me. So when I've got a new sexual partner, I check for consent at every stage. And to most guys, this is going to seem really strange, but I would say, is this okay? Is this okay? Is this okay? Now, women love it. because they feel safe and looked after, and they think I'm some kind of really right on caring guy. No, I'm actually covering my own ass because I don't know if I've got consent, whereas most guys probably will instinctively know they've got consent because they can read body language, facial expressions, and all the social nuances. I can't. Well, that's how I've had to deal with it. Well, the same would apply for any boundary I can't, or any other autistic person cannot intuitively grasp. We have to check. Well, why should we not have to learn these things? It's not up to others to say, well, it's okay if he violates my space because he's autistic. No, that's not a good excuse. That's not a good reason.
Mm.
Parents who don't give boundaries to their children it's a form of child abuse because they're not giving their children the skills they need. It's neglectful. So, if we withheld food, if we withheld medical attention, education from our children, no one would argue that's abusive, certainly neglectful. I think it's the same if you don't vaccinate your children too. You know, you're withholding some kind of medical thing. But where we don't see this being classed as abuse is when we don't give children the tools they need to survive as young adults and then adults. Well, that's just as neglectful. So when we have schools having non-competitive sports days, what lesson are we giving them to the children? Oh, everyone's a winner. They go out into the job market or the business community and they realize, shit, everyone is not a fucking winner at all. But I was taught at school this doesn't happen. Wow. Well, then we get Twitter, then we get LinkedIn, then we get social media.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I think it's Jonathan Haidt talks about this in The Coddling of the American Mind about the about how some of these kids are going literally through high school, straight into college, and then out into these kind of startups and tech firms, and also blue chip companies as well. And these managers in these blue chip companies really don't know what to do with them because they're kind of like, they've got this kind of entitled brat complex that is kind of like the whole world shifts on its axis for me, and woe betide anyone that doesn't do as I want, sort of thing. And it's kind of throwing their sort of toys out of the pram. But I think, again, it comes back to this sort of, I mentioned before about our job as parents being to prepare our kids for the world as it is, not the world as we would like it to be. And I think that if you are bringing up kids, especially neurodivergent kids, and without any consequence or boundaries at all, then you're like, oh, actually, so you're making it more difficult for them to function in the world as it is versus what you would like it to be. Because, you know, I have this go through my mind on a not too infrequent basis. I think, as does any parent of a neurodivergent child, what are they going to do when I'm no longer here? Well, they're going to have to find a way to function. There's no two ways about it. And the easiest way to pave the way for that is to do as much as I can to help them function in the world as it is whilst I'm still here, because I can't, you know, that they're getting as much as they possibly can out of me before I'm no longer around. But the idea that I'm just going to think, oh yeah, what I'm going to do is I'm going to make it as easy as I can do while I'm around. And then when I'm fucking no longer here, they're going to be like, they're going to go completely fucking berserk because they've not been prepared for what is inevitably going to come, you know?
But right, I see some parents of autistic children being quite emphatic about not telling their kids they're autistic.
Mm.
And some won't even get their kids assessed because they don't want them labeled. Well, the label is actually very useful because it gives the children access then to services. And well, that's fairly superficial in some ways, as I'll come to in a moment. They gives the child access to external services they won't otherwise have access to. And when I was a kid, autism wasn't a thing. I was just an awkward little shit, you know? I'm not saying I'm not an awkward little shit now, but I'm also autistic. But another thing is not telling a child it's autistic when it is, and therefore no one else knows it's autistic, does not hide the fact. Because as an autistic person, I can tell you, and I've had this conversation with autistic people as well, we go through life thinking, why on earth am I like this? Why have I been put on this planet full of alien creatures I don't understand? Not telling your child it's autistic will not change that. So your child is going to go through life, regardless of whether you have it assessed or whether you say you're autistic or not, knowing it is different. Furthermore, everyone else knows you're different too, because it stands out like a hard-on in a nudist kindergarten. You know, everybody knows the autistic kid is not quite normal, for whatever normal means. It's a spectrum, so there's a large presentation, but rude, maybe stands a little bit too close, doesn't mix well, doesn't share, very literal, doesn't get sarcasm or humor. There's a huge spectrum, and some of those apply to me too. Not the standing too close thing. I don't like being close to too many people. But a lot of that.
I won't give you a man hug. I won't give you a man hug when I meet you in person then, John. You won't like that.
That's not so bad. If I know it's coming and I'm okay with
it. I'll pre-warn you.
I'm prepared for it. But it's people who I don't know. Like, I mean, Americans are very physical and friendly without context, if you like. I don't like that at all. And I just say, no, don't, please, don't touch me. I don't like it. If it's someone I know, that's different, especially if I'm expecting it. But, you know, the child itself will know it is different. And if you tell the child it's different and why, well, then they can self-educate and come to terms with themselves. And everyone can make, at least be prepared to make accommodations. Some will, and unfortunately some won't. Some people don't seem to understand that they can meet me in my world if they want to. I cannot meet them in theirs. I can't suddenly learn to read body language and facial expressions. In the same way, it's a bit like saying to a deaf person, but I tell you what, I'll meet you halfway. I'll talk a little bit more loudly, but you listen harder too.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like that. I can't meet you in your world, but you can meet me in mine. And if you don't want to do that, that's fine. I can't make you, and I'm not going to try and force you to, but, you know, that just means that we ain't going to communicate very well. Yeah. And that's a choice you're making, really.
Yeah.
So not telling your child it's autistic, not getting it assessed because you want to avoid a label, is again, to me, it's a form of neglect.
Mm.
You're not giving
denial as well. Well, it's denial as well, because I think
it is denial.
Because I've seen parents where it's kind of like, it's literally, they've got this perfect little image in their head of their little prince or princess, and they're kind of like, hang on a minute, if I admit that they are different, then they're somehow an inferior product to what I thought they were going to be.
Yes. There's a stigma attached to it. Now, I informally mentor a range of autistic men, women, and some older kids. I wouldn't do very young children. I'm not qualified. I don't particularly like young children anyway. They're okay to distance and to play with them, but, you know, fuck off. I'm not interested in them that much. But I'm just not. I'm just not a...
I know what you mean. I know what you mean. Them, you know? I said to my... It's really funny. When my girls were tiny, we'd been out with some friends and they had babies of, you know, similar age to my daughter and whatever. And that. And I said to my wife, I said, look, I don't mean this in a mean way, but I really couldn't give a shit about other people's babies. I love ours, but I really couldn't care. I really couldn't care. I don't care whether they've been teething. I don't care whether they've just done a shit and they're happy. I just really don't care. I don't even want to hold them. Right. I just, she was like, oh, that's all right, sweetheart. And I was like, I'm only interested in ours. They're the apple of my eye, but I've no interest in other keepers' babies or toddlers or whatever and stuff. I said,
no, I mean,
I apologize if that makes me like a harsh person, but I just, there's just not even on my radar.
No, I'm indifferent to other people's children, and often they're irritating, especially when they're badly behaved. It's just true, isn't it? Yeah, autistic children. Should be told as early as possible, so they can at least learn to deal with these things. Because what happens is, you see, we learn to mask, and masking is exhausting. And come middle age, early middle age, you basically have a middle-aged autistic meltdown, breakdown. Kind of catastrophe, whatever you'd like to call it. And that's what happened to me. Massive anxiety and stuff. And it's because you've been playing a part for so long. And we sometimes, I mean, depending on your presentation as well, I mean, I've got the Asperger's flavor, which I'm very grateful for, because it means I'm incredibly intelligent. I think incredibly quickly. And all the usual, to me, benefits come along with Asperger's. Some autistic people are probably less fortunate. Many of them, some of them can't even self-toilet, you know, they can't control their physical bodies enough. And that must be difficult. I'm clumsy, but at least I can wipe my own arse, you know. I see it as a great thing. I wouldn't want to be different, even if I could be.
And I think that's a good point, actually, John, because like I reached a stage last year where I said, it was a very stressful year last year because my my eldest had an eating disorder, and for whatever reason, it was one of those years that kind of brought me to my knees a little bit. But I was also having chronic difficulty in focusing, concentrating. My brain was all over the place. And by pure accident, I'd seen a post about ADHD, and it was like, oh, these are the things I deal with ADHD. And then basically all the people replying to it, I was like, these are interesting. I struggle with that. And I was like, right, let's do an online questionnaire. And then I did another online questionnaire. So about four or five questionnaires in, I was like 99% on all of the questionnaires. And so I spoke to my wife and I said, look, I've got something to tell you. I think that, and she was like, well, I've known that for the last 20 odd years, sort of thing. So it's no great shock to her, sort of thing. And she said, well, what do you want to do? Do you want to get diagnosed? And I was like, yeah, I can get diagnosed. I said, but I don't think that, I think for me, I'd just like to know what it means. So I did a bit of research by myself because I'm kind of a resourceful chap, found out about, you know, hyperfocus, found out about, what is it called? Rejection sensitivity dysphoria or whatever, which is basically where you take rejection from people really bad. I found out about dopamine, how that impacts neurodivergent people and particularly people with ADHD. So I built up this picture of, you know, what are the different working memory, remembering stuff. I can remember stuff that happened 6 months ago, but in terms of what people have just told me, it's like a goldfish brain. It kind of goes literally one ear. It's like, you've got a handkerchief and so I kind of ran it in between my ears. There's nothing there for like work. I think they call it working memory. So you build up a picture, and then I delved into some of the ADHD forums and content online and whatever. And you find that there is kind of this kind of, again, with just general general content, not aimed at neurodivergent people. There is woe is me side of the camp on one side of it, which, oh, this is wrecking my life. It's just, then you've got the kind of, this is a superpower on the other side of it. I think it's just better. To be honest, I think it's better off to actually be in the middle and just say, look, this is something I've got. It gives me these challenges that I need to overcome. I'm best to equip myself and learn about these challenges and how me as a person uniquely operates with it. And actually look at, because I functioned as a human being up until this point. It's not like I'm a blithering idiot that's kind of can't even hold down the job or can't even get up in the morning. Well, you know, hang on a minute. I managed to press the record button on the Zoom call. But it's not as, at first I thought, well, it's not as bad as it seems. You know, it's another thing that I need to kind of be aware of. And it's learning about myself, which is what non-neurodivergent people have to do as well. They have to learn about themselves. Is it a kind of handicap or disability? Well, it depends how you want to look at it. There's a guy I interviewed on the podcast called Mark Ulmrod, who was the first triple amputee out of the Afghanistan conflict, an ex-Marine. So he's competed in the Invictus Games. He's raised thousands of pounds for charity. He does fucking Brazilian jiu-jitsu as a triple amputee, and he's got a belt in it as well. So you sort of look at people like him and you look at other people and you're like, hang on a minute. I could have a hell of a lot more shit to deal with and overcome than what this presents to me.
Things ain't so bad.
It's not so bad. It's going to present some challenges, but they're not insurmountable challenges. It just means I have to work around stuff and find a way that works for me and stuff and that. But I think there is sometimes this idea that this is the end of the world, when in actual fact it's just another challenge you have to overcome as a person. Like, yeah, my dad used to say about in terms of putting things into perspective, because he was quite well read on the Middle East, he would be, you know, he'd say that things aren't going that well, but put it this way, my whole family could have been wiped out in a mortar bomb attack.
Yeah.
So all my compared to that guy, it's relative, isn't it? Like,
I remember when I had my diagnosis. It's actually we're recording this on the 25th. It was 4 years ago yesterday, the 24th of April. My Aspiversary, as I call it. And I remember the woman said, "Well, there's no down diagnosing you now with Asperger's, and then there's a few other things, comorbid alexithymia." And I think I'm also ADHD from what people say, but it's hard because there's a lot of overlap and it doesn't really matter. And if it walks like a duck, it quacks like a duck, I'm going to treat it like a duck, you know? And I remember I said to her, I was kind of blown away a little bit and very relieved because I thought, if I'm not diagnosed as Asperger's, I'm just an arsehole. You know, what the fuck is wrong with me? So I remember saying to her, I said, you know, this changes everything. But it also changes nothing. I'm the same bloke walking out the room as I was walking in. But now I've got a perspective on it. I know why I am like I am. I know why the past has been like the past. But more important, it helps me now plan for the future. Hmm. And I've turned my business partner, Connor, he's brilliant. We are best friends as well as business partners. We've built the entire business around a lot of I won't say shortcomings, but around the challenges my autism causes, such as working practice. I have executive dysfunction. I don't know, it's an inability or an unwillingness to be nice to people for too long, peopling, you know, focus, that whole raft of things, which may be interested to share with you offline because of your kid. But we've built the entire business around, I've got this fucking box of challenges, which is pretty, the box is pretty much immutable. There's not a lot I can do. Like when I travel, and people watching this and listening to it might find it a bit hard to believe. When I travel as special needs because it's just too overwhelming. The noise, the people, the complexity, the sounds, the brightness. I always wear this hat.
Have you got the sunflower lanyard that goes around your neck?
That's the one. I wear a hat all the time because it keeps the glare out of my eyes because I'm very photosensitive. I'm clumsy, all these things. And we've built an entire business around it. But I play to my strengths as well. As a mentor and a coach, I'm unparalleled. Why? Not because it's necessarily just my knowledge, my experience in the area I coach and mentor in, but also, and this is probably the most important thing, is there's absolutely zero chance of me being dragged emotionally into your bullshit. Mm. So I will sit there in a hot seat, say, in our mentoring group, and if you've got a challenge, I'm going to get the truth out of you. Now, I don't bully. I don't browbeat. I don't shout and raise my voice. I don't humiliate. But I get you to tell me the truth. And I have no compunction. I don't care if you're crying. We'll just stop for a little while. Then we'll carry on until I get to the truth. And people know this coming in. And they actually appreciate it. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I'm no good as a coach or a mentor if at the first sign of adversity from you or your resistance, you tell me the truth, I stop. There's no point. I can't do my job unless I know the truth.
Yeah, which is rare.
I think it's maybe a better parent. So I'm objective, very objective about things.
Yeah, and it's rare in this day and age. And one of the biggest turning points in my life was when I joined a brotherhood in the US. And you did have that accountability where you had to park your ego at the door. And if you had a plan to do something and you weren't following that plan and you were making excuses as to why you hadn't, then you sure as hell someone is going to say to you, why not?
Well, why are you not doing that? It's not true.
It's like saying
one thing and doing another.
It's like wriggling with like a worm on the hook. There's a buddy of mine, Ryan Mickler, calls it the integrity gap, where you know what you should be doing, but you're not doing what you should be doing. And it's this gap that, and I think for most people, it's kind of narrowing that gap down. So there's kind of, right, I know what I should be doing. I'm going to do it. And
let's face it, integrity is hard. I mean, it's easy in one way. I mean, if you make the decision to have integrity, that's an easy decision to make, and it's a profound one to make. And I made it a long time ago, but there are times when sticking to that is not easy.
Hmm.
And that's when it's most important.
Yeah, and particularly in this world as well, because we live in a very accountability averse, blame-ridden culture that. Where it's kind of like actually
it's always
somebody else's fault. And when I was younger, I was like, oh, why are middle-aged people so bloody grumpy and cynical about shit? And I'm just like, now I am that guy. I'm like, actually,
you're grumpy and cynical about shit.
Yeah, I'm getting annoyed because they've not relayed the pavement correctly and shit like that. And just like, I'm just like, my wife's like, why are you getting annoyed about that? And I'm just like, because why do we bother paying taxes if they're not going to do a proper job? And then you're like, but there's not. She was like, why don't you complain? I was like, I'm not going to try and conquer the Teflon towers of West Sussex County Council and actually get to speak to someone if I'm very lucky about it. And then they just put my complaint in the low-level filing cabinet. I'm not even going to bother. It just like, it's going to wind me up even more trying to do that. But you know, that's a whole, yeah, that is actually a book that I would probably like, that I actually might write at some stage in the future, The Blame Game, and how modern society is prioritizing accountability, aversion and stuff, because I think that a lot of our structures in society now that we kind of, that we used to trust and think, yeah, that's a dependable institution, and that's something we can trust, and that's, no, they wouldn't behave dishonestly, and they are all, well, it's what I call Teflon towers, where you just, nothing sticks. It's just like,
well, when I was a kid, it was like, if you're in trouble, you need help, ask a policeman. I wouldn't teach my kids that now.
No.
I think that attitude has been vindicated by this mess in the Met. You know, the police are not dependable. They do cover up for each other and themselves. I've got a thing I call the blame equation. Choices plus actions equal consequences. And this is always true. We always have a choice. We might have a choice between a shitty thing and a really shitty thing, but it's still a choice. It's a choice not to throw yourself off a bridge every morning. You know, killing yourself or not killing yourself is a choice. And we all make it every single day. And I don't attach any moral value to these choices necessarily, not if they only concern yourself and you don't violate someone else's rights. But, you know, whatever you choose, you'll take actions based on that choice. And then the consequences, you have to own them. This is a fundamental part. And the hierarchy you go in my business is in terms of mentorship or whatever, working with one-on-one, this becomes more and more important. And I always say to people, you know, you are free to choose anything you like. And I'm not going to gainsay you. There are choices you can make that mean I don't want to be your friend or deal with you. That's fine. But, you know, any choice you make is entirely up to you. And you are free to make any choice you want. But one thing you are never, ever entitled to do is abdicate responsibility for your choices. You just not. So, you know, you want to murder someone, you want to kill someone, that's a choice. You kill them, that's an action. The consequence, well, someone's dead and you go to prison for the rest of your life and it's ruined and your kid's life's ruined. Well, that was a choice, you know. You violate people's rights, you pay the penalty. You know, it's as simple as that. Well, it's similar to, well, anything in business. You know, I get people saying to me, because the thing I'm big on is raising your prices. I don't want to raise my prices, it feels wrong. Okay, fine, don't raise your prices then. That's a choice. The action is you're going to work harder than you need to. The consequence is you're going to work it all day. You're going to have shitty clients. You won't have much money. Your business might go bust. You might lose your house. This is a choice. I'm not going to sit here and feel sorry for you, because it's the choice you've made. You know, here are the facts. Deal with them as you wish.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm glad that you segued into your business, actually, because so when I first started Guild of Dads, I come from, as you know, I've got a bricks and mortar day job, so to speak. And when I first started Guild of Dads and podcasting and working with guys and setting up communities for men and stuff and that, you know, the first thing that people said to me was, oh yeah, set up an Instagram account and a Facebook group and start to build a following and whatnot. It goes on and on and on and on. And this is the kind of stock advice given to everyone right now, which kind of, when I think about it, coming from a bricks and mortar background, it just seems like blanket advice. And one of the things I said to someone actually this morning was, in terms of followings was, no, yesterday it was, we were talking about a guy who has got 40,000 following on Instagram. And I know of guys who, and I've spoken to guys who have got followings of say 250,000 on Twitter. Okay. But I've had one-to-one conversations with some of these guys. Nice chaps, but know nothing. And I think a massive amount of credibility, what I've realized in the last 2-3 years, is a massive amount of credibility is given to people with massive followings. But in actual fact, when you get them on a one-to-one call, they know fuck all. And which presents a bit of a problem because, as you know, people are placing credibility in these people as being experts in how to build a following, how to build a business on Twitter, LinkedIn, or Instagram, whatever other these platforms are. Like some of the guys I've seen on Twitter and Instagram in particular, they've got massive followings, but they're not doing anything with that either. So there's no link to, there's no way that they're monetizing it or doing anything with it. And you just kind of like, okay, so Surely if you're the expert in this, then you would have, at the very, very, very least, a one-page PDF or something which is deplatforming people off of this place and onto your owned land as opposed to your rented land. I mean, so it just, there is a disconnect going on within business right now in terms of social. And I know I'm presenting the ground to unleash your wrath, John.
Well, I'll keep it short because we're about at the top of the hour we've done now, but I'll say a couple of things to this. The first is, this is about celebrity. And if you want to see how absurd celebrity is, we have Hollywood celebrities, actors, holding forth on medical issues like vaccination, for instance, like Robert De Niro and on vaccines and autism, which has been shown over and over again. There is no link whatsoever. On the contrary, actually, the incidence of autism among vaccinated children is less than the incidence of autism among non-vaccinated kids. And also, there's a high proportion of autistic researchers working in vaccines. So actually, autism causes vaccines, not the other way around. But we listen to celebrities in Hollywood and places on issues like medicine and science and things. These people get paid for pretending to be other people. That's their sole. That's what they do. That's what they get paid for. That's their skill. They pretend to be other people, and we ask their opinions on complex engineering, scientific, and mathematical and medical things. Why would we do that? Because we're fucking stupid. That's why. The other thing is, I actually did a kind of mathematical treatise on social media marketing. I'm autistic, of course I did. Right. And it shows quite unequivocally how it is always going to be inferior to a direct marketing approach. Using typical numbers in a typical business and the LinkedIn platform, we're looking at a direct marketing response. Direct response marketing approach is about 550 times more effective. Can't argue with the maths. I'll share you the document with you, but I don't want it to go any further because that's for clients only. But I don't know. We're on this podcast, so I'll share it with you. It's quite clear, using set theory, it's quite clear. They can't argue with the maths. Some people do, though, because they're fucking stupid. They work with their feelings rather than the facts. So, yeah, social media marketing. A question to ask, and I'll throw this out to everybody. When you see someone on any platform, LinkedIn, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, whatever, telling you how many views, shares, comments, and likes they've had, and using that as some kind of metric for the success of their businesses, and especially if they're trying to sell you something, ask them a simple question. It will probably get you blocked, but ask it anyway, and just ask them, how much money did that make you? How many sales did you make from that? I know a woman, she's a client, who had 1 million views on LinkedIn of her content over 6 months, and it was an experiment she did. And she quite openly admits she didn't make a single sale from it. Mm-hmm. Now, in my content, I get very few views. I get almost no engagement. But I'll probably get 2 or 3 calls booked a week, maybe say 6 in a month. And my close rate on a 5-figure program is 75%. So I get fuck all in terms of views, likes, shares, comments, and views, but I get a lot of sales. And I'd rather have it that way. Can't go to Tesco and buy my shopping with likes, shares, comments, and views, but I can with cash.
Yeah, that's a good point. That is a good point. And it's experience that I'm beginning to learn as well in what I'm doing, as you know. So John, it's been an absolute pleasure. You're right, we have got up to the hour, and we could easily do a 3-hour and maybe a part two. Maybe the answer is a part
two. Yeah, I'm happy to come back if you want me. Yeah.
Part two. Tell listeners where they can find out about you. What's the best way to find out about you? Get in touch with you and come into your world. Be warned, people, that if you fuck this man about, he will just bin you off completely.
Yeah. The easiest way to get some idea of what we do is to go to wellfedbusiness.com. If you do want to email me, which is always fine, I'm always respectful and polite and stuff, but I don't give free advice. I don't think I do. That is EBG, as in evil, bold, genius, EBG@wellfedbusiness.com. And you can get me there. Or go to evilboldgenius.com. I'm also there. That's my website. So that's how to get hold of me. Awesome. Or ask Joe. He'll put you in touch.
Yeah. Or ask me. I'll link all this up in the show notes. The other thing I was going to ask you, and I don't prime any of the guests for this question, John, what is it in life that gives you meaning?
Sorry, service to others. I mean that very specifically. I mean, please, I don't want anyone thinking that means I'm a walkover or a doormat or obsequious or servile, you know, because you have to qualify to receive that service. But once you do, I will bend over backwards. And that extends to children, wife, clients, friends, whatever. Service to others. There is great satisfaction in that. It's also quite lonely. So the leadership position is quite I don't say lonely, because I don't know what loneliness feels like being alexithymic, but it's a very isolated position. And it's one I made a conscious choice to embrace and adopt as an older man. And I'm glad I did. It's worthwhile, I think, but not everybody's going to be cut out for it or indeed capable of it.
I love it. I love it. John, thank you very much for joining me today. I appreciate you and the work you're doing, and keep putting your evil ball geniusness out into the world.
So. I fully intend to do so, sir. See you later.
Take care, man.